ॐ भद्रं कर्णे तिष्ठन्याम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षधीर्यचक्राः स्थिरगङ्गैश्चिष्टवागुं संस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितन्यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
So we'll chant starting with Rig Pumsadikam. The person you have respect with that? For me it's number 8.
Vritpundarikam virajam vishuddham. Vritpundarikam virajam vishuddham. Vichincha madhye vishadam vishokam. Vichincha madhye vishadam vishokam. Achincham avyaktam anantarupam. Achincham avyaktam anantarupam. Shivam prashantam amritam brahmayonim. Shivam prashantam amritam brahmayonim. Tamadi madhyantam vihinamekam. Tamadi madhyantam vihinamekam. Vibhum charanandam arupam adbhutam. Vibhum charanandam arupam adbhutam. Umasahayam parameshwaram prabhum. Umasahayam parameshwaram prabhum. Trilochanam nilakantam prashantam. Trilochanam nilakantam prashantam. Jyakwa munir gacchati bhutayonim. Jyakwa munir gacchati bhutayonim. Samastasakshinam tamasaparastat. Samastasakshinam tamasaparastat. Quick review of the Ritpundarikam. Vichintyam.
Did you do this Sunday?
Was it last week or 2 weeks
ago? Oh, okay.
I'll do it quickly. Ritpundarikam virajam vishuddham vichintya madhye vishadam vishokam achintyam avyaktam ananta rupam Shivam Prashantam Amritam Brahma Yonim Tam Adi Madhya Anta Vihinam Ekam Vibhum Chit Anandam Arupam Adbhutam Uma Sahayam Parama Ishwaram Prabhum Tri Lochanam Nila Kantam Prashantam Dhyatva Munihi Gachati Bhuta Yomim Samasta Sakshinam Tamasaha Parastat. So just to quickly review the first 8. Hrit means the buddhi. It also means the buddhi, but that's specifically meaning the heart. So it's talking about the mind, but the mind which is pundarikam, like a lotus, so the lotus heart. So that mind which is, in fact, pleasing like a lotus. Being virajam, free of rajas, free of raga dvesha, free of your likes and dislikes, virajam, vishuddham, also pure, again free of raga dvesha. Virajam means really free of the rajas, right? Free of agitation. Vishuddham you can take free of raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes. Now vichintya here is more than thinking about, we're talking about dhyanam here, so it's visualizing. let's keep it as visualizing for now. Visualizing, having visualized Madhye in the middle of the heart, which is Pundarikam, the lotus heart, the heart which is like a lotus, which is pleasing like a lotus. It's why my Swamiji says it, that's why I'm bringing this up, pleasing like a lotus. Vishuddham, which is pure. Vishuddham can be Vishuddham pure, pure like a clean slate of glass or clean water that is purely reflecting the sky, Vishuddham. Vishokam, free of sorrow. Achintyam, so remember that, I'm just going quickly through these because we worked on it the week before last. Achintyam is that which cannot be thought about. The mind can't take on the form. Chinta means to think. Achintyam, that which cannot be objectified by the mind. Avyaktam is that which cannot be objectified by the sense perception, because avyaktam means that which doesn't come into manifestation. So if you have both achintyam and avyaktam, achintyam means that which can't be thought about. Avyaktam means that which has no form, it doesn't come into manifestation. So you can differentiate these two. One, it can't be objectified by the mind, and avyaktam, it can't be perceived by the sense organs. So achintyam, avyaktam, anantarupam, and at the same time, it is all forms. There's no form that's away from it, even though itself can't be objectified. Okay. At the same time, it is the truth of all forms. So if you say something is, it exists, but it's not something that can be objectified, and yet it is all forms. Ananta means without end, limitless. It is all forms. That means it's the truth of all of the forms. And not only is it the truth of all of the forms that you perceive and that you can think about, it's the truth of this form too. It's the truth of your body, of your mind, of your sense organs, because these are also forms. Right? And so what is not objectifiable but is all forms means it has to be the very being, the very self of all of the forms, and there's no form which is away for it from it, because it is anantarupam. It is, the forms are limitless. So the forms that make up the whole Maya Upadhi, the whole creation, it is the self of that. It is the essence, the truth of that. It's like if we look at the wave ocean, there's limitless forms, limitless waves. And each wave is different from the other. And all of the waves make up the ocean. So the anantarupam would be all of the waves in the ocean. And all there is the ocean, that's it. And there's limitless forms in the ocean. But what is the self of, what is all of those, what is all of those waves? Is the water, right? And so the water is anantarupam. It is the self of all of the forms. And so here the Atma is anantarupam. It is all of these forms. There's no form that's away from it. So it is the very being of all of the forms, anantarupam. It is Shivam, that which is auspicious. It is Prashantam. Prashantam means, as long as you will define Prashantam sometimes, it's Vikara Rahitam. Vikara Rahitam. It's free. Prashanti is that which is free of any type of modification. So I like that. Vikara means a modification. Like, for instance, your mind has one thought after another thought after another thought. All of the experiences in the world are going through one modification after another modification. Brahman has no modification. It's absolute shanti. It's absolute peace. There's not a ripple. In Advaita, in what is non-dual, there's no second thing. There's no place for there to be a ripple. There's no second thing there. And so the shanti is absolute. There's absolute, it's absolutely devoid. Rahitam means without any type of modification. And so it is just being itself, which by its own swarupa, by its own nature, is self-evident. And so I said this a little in meditation. Self-evident being. We can say being is consciousness, consciousness is being. Or we can just say being is self-evident. That's like saying being is consciousness. being is self-evident means it is its own light. It's self-aware, not aware of anything. It just is awareness. So being itself is self-evident. Why I like it, I like what Swamiji uses these terms, self-evident being, is because those words don't imply knowership of something. Because usually when we think of the word consciousness or awareness, we think of conscious, when I think of myself as consciousness, we'll often think of I am conscious, what makes me conscious is that I'm conscious of something, rather than just conscious being. See, if I were to remove all names and forms and remove the whole creation, in fact, we remove the subject-object relationship, seer-seeing relationship, then there's just consciousness, but not consciousness of anything. So if it's just consciousness, and consciousness exists, say if we say there is consciousness and only consciousness, that's all, then consciousness is. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist. So being and consciousness are one and the same thing, unless consciousness comes and goes. Consciousness comes and goes, then it has to depend on, well, that gets complicated, it has to depend upon something else for its being. But if consciousness and existence are one and the same thing, right, then consciousness has nothing to do with being consciousness of something. It just is consciousness. And so, what is that? Well, that is what we mean by self-evident being. My being is not being illumined by anything. That's what we mean by self-evident. There's a nice little piece of logic here also around that. In the subject-object, world of subject-object relationship, I can say all of you in this room is illumined by my eyes, subject-object. I can say my mind illumines my eyes. That's how I know my eyes. I'm aware of my eyes, subject-object. So I can go inward like that, right? And then I can say, I illumine my mind. Consciousness illumines the mind, subject-object. Okay? Could start that way, subject-object, because the mind is known. So now we're at awareness illumining the mind, right? Because the mind is known. Sense organs are known by the mind. The objects are known by the sense organs. So objects, sense organs, mind, consciousness illumines the mind. I illumine the mind. Who illumines me? Who illumines the consciousness? Consciousness illumines the mind. Awareness illumines the mind. Who illumines the awareness? So we could say, well, some other awareness illumines the awareness. An innermost awareness illumines that awareness. And then what illumines that awareness? Well, it must be another awareness illumines that awareness. You can get into what that would amount to if you were to go that route, is an infinite regress, right? Awareness illumines awareness, illumines awareness, illumines awareness, illumines awareness, illumines awareness, illumines awareness, infinite regress. If you have literally an infinite regress is necessary there, say that's true, an infinite regress is necessary, then awareness would never be known because it's an infinite regress. So if you go awareness, so awareness is necessary to illumine the awareness, another awareness is necessary to illumine that, another awareness is necessary to illumine that, and that's an infinite regress because there's no way to stop it, you'll never reach the end. And so the end, there is no awareness then. It will never reach you because it's infinite. And so then, when we do get to, when we go through this subject-object, 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 like we're doing, and we get to awareness, awareness illumines the mind, right? Subject-object. Now say I take away the object. Because if I'm aware, like this, my sense organs are aware of these objects, I take away the objects, or I turn my back, I turn around. These objects are gone. I'm not dependent upon what I'm illumining, what I have a subject-object relationship with. They can be here or not be here. They're extrinsic. The experiences are extrinsic. They don't have to do with me. I'm involved with them because I'm aware of them. But if they go away, nothing happens to me. So in the subject-object inquiry, I end up at myself, the innermost conscious being, which is me. I end up at with me, the awareful being. Who is illumining the awareful being? Me, the awareful, because it goes like this. Sense organs illumine the objects. Mind illumines the sense organs and has its own thoughts and whatnot. And I illumine those. Right? I illumine the mind. Who illumines me? Not the mind. The mind is illumined. The mind comes and goes. Right? The thought is, I am. The thought is gone. I still am. The thoughts aren't in, they're extrinsic. They're not intrinsic to me. So now who and what illumines me, the conscious being? Is there another consciousness required? Or can there even be another consciousness? In other words, do I need an awareness to illumine my awareness? Or is my awareness self-evident? If it's self-evident, if I am self-evident, that is the bottom line. I can't get beyond me. I can't get behind consciousness. I can't get to the side of consciousness. I can't circumvent consciousness. I can't go around it. It is the intrinsic me. It's the me that I can't change, or I can't toy with. I can't change its nature in any way. It is the self that, it is the intrinsic me, the self-evident me, that is absolutely present to all the extrinsic experiences, which include even the I thought, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this, I feel like this, I feel like that. That's the I thought. That's a thought. It's illumined. It's known. It comes and goes. I don't walk around thinking, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. I don't need the thought. But because I, the intrinsic me, is always present, that thought which is labeling me in reference to all my experience is going to be coming again and again and again. That's what we call the ahamkara. But that thought is not necessary. It's extrinsic. It comes and it goes. All my emotions, all of my feelings are extrinsic. They come and they go, but whenever they are there, right, they're not away from me. The me conscious being that I am is pervasive to those thoughts, right? But the thoughts are extrinsic. I am pervasive. I am the truth. I feel the thought to be the conscious being that I am, feel the experience. But I am not intrinsic to those experiences, and those experiences are extrinsic to me. So what I need to recognize in my experience is the one that is never dabbled with in any way, never touched in any way by any of these objectifiable experiences. And for that me, when I get down to just the awareness, that awareness is self-evident. Why do we say self-evident? Because I can't objectify it. There's no other awareness behind it to objectify it. And if I required another awareness behind it to objectify it, that would be an infinite regress, because what's going to objectify that awareness? And so if another awareness is required behind me to objectify me, then I can't be known. Then awareness itself can't be known. Because infinite regress, and you never get to the end of it. See what I mean? So the awareness, the being that you are, the awareness that you are, you have to say, it's self-effulgent. It's self-evident. You can't get behind the awareness with another awareness, because that would be an infinite regress. And so your being is your being. There's nothing you can do about it. And that's very freeing, in fact. It's very freeing. in meditation or at any time, once you notice that, oh, they're talking about me, my own presence, the one that, just think about this. In meditation, you know, when you're shutting down everything, you're relaxing and withdrawing your sense organs, withdrawing your mind, making the mind become quiet. Turning your sense organs away from your perceptions, quietening your mind. The whole while, all that's happening is that yourself is coming to the forefront. Because all these other things are being shut down. You're not being shut down. You're just sitting more and more and more with your own presence, the self-evident me. That's all that's happening. There's never any negation whatsoever of your own being. If anything, there's the highlighting of your own being. Right? Not the negation of it. And what you're left with, the deeper you go, you're left with what? Self-evident me, the one that has nothing behind it. Nothing to objectify it. Just simple, my own very simple presence that makes me me. That is what is intrinsic. That is what my swarupa is. And that's why sometimes in meditation you can have the mind ask yourself, what am I like? What is this me? You can even say, well, this me, the self-evident person, what is its nature? And that's why all of these words that we're using here are simply meant to point to that nature. It is prashantam. There are no vikaras, no modifications at all. It's completely still. It's shivam. That nature that you are is the most auspicious, the most beloved, the most whole, you know, the most sacred. It's amritam. Amritam means not, it has two meanings. One meaning is nectar, means it is the most sweet. Another meaning for amritam is it is immortal. It's free from time, it's free from change, it's free from death. And so when you have differentiated yourself from your being, from all of these things that can be objectified, like your body and your mind and your sense organs, all of these perceptions that may or may not be there, you're left with a self that is non-objectifiable. A self that is non-objectifiable as an object within creation itself is free from time. Time is objectifiable. Objects are objectifiable. And so this presence that I am is amritam, it's free from death. And this, so having visualized all of this, then he goes on, it's brahmayonim. Brahmayonim means it is that Brahman which is the source of all things, because yoni means womb, cause. It's brahmayonim, it's Brahman, it's the infinite which is the cause. Means you can't, material cause, you can't get behind that being. Every experience that you have reduces to that being. Because all of the experiences are mitya, all of them come and go and come and go and come and go. Everything in your experience is like that, everything in the creation is like that. The only thing that doesn't come and go in terms of the experience of the creation is the being itself. And so that being itself is the yoni. It's the cause. It is what is actually there. By cause means material cause. It is what is actually there. It's the water of the ocean. Right? There's nothing behind it. There's no being or substance behind it. And then it goes on. So these are all words pointing to what one has to recognize at the time of contemplation. And he says, tam adi medjantam vihinam. He said, that self is adi, beginning, madhya, middle, antam, end, vihinam. It has no beginning, middle, or end. Consciousness itself, there is no coming into being of consciousness. There is no coming into being of being. Existence doesn't have a birth. What would be its prior condition? Existence itself has no birth. So your amness, the being that you are, has no prior condition. It didn't come into being. It doesn't have a middle, and it doesn't have an end. It means it's not subject to time. There's no beginning to consciousness. There's no end to consciousness, and so it has no middle because it's free from time. What that means is this me, this being that you are, that your presence, the me that you are, isn't growing old. The me that you are right now is the me that you are. From the standpoint of the universe, which is subject to time, marked time, I could go back 5 billion years, and it is the me that you are right now that is illumining it. The me that you are right now, if I go 5 billion years into the future, it is the me that you are right now that is illumining it. Consciousness is not growing old, right? Because free from time. And so the self that you are, now remember, the self that you are, we're not talking about some self that you need to discover. We're talking about the self, like, by that I mean, let me meditate so I can have an experience of the self, as though that experience is not the you that is here right now. There is no experience of the self out there to be had, other than what you take to be yourself right now. The big revelation is not the discovery of a new self. It's the discovery that yourself, the self that you take yourself to be right now, is amritam, is free from time, is prashantam, is all of these things that it, in fact, even though seen from the standpoint of the body, the mind says, I am this body. I am this body. I am this emotion. I am this thought. I am finite. I am subject to death because I identify my being with all these things, which it isn't. Myself isn't these things. When these things fall, nothing happens to me. It's like if I drop a pot through space, I might have thought there was pot space, but when I drop the pot through space, the space is. Nothing has happened to it at all. Right? If I drop, I think, oh, this pot, look at this pot, beautiful pot space, look inside, it's that beautiful pot space, oops, I drop it. The pot is broken, it's died. What happened to the pot space? There never was any pot space. That was an illusion. So nothing happened. What about when you have a dream? And it's one of those very vivid dreams, and you've taken a character in the dream, and all this stuff is happening. You know? And the alarm clock goes off, and the whole dream goes away. Everything, the whole dream universe goes away, and your dream character, that you were so engaged in some very important mission, whatever it was, it is totally gone. Like that. What is the death experience? Very interesting. What is the death experience there? Because there's been a huge catastrophe. Right? From the standpoint of the dream world, it has gone. The whole thing has, poof, it's gone. And all of the individuals in it. What is the death experience? Even another interesting thing, some people actually have died in their dream. I don't know if you've had that experience where you have a character in the dream. This is very rare, actually. In fact, we don't expect this to happen, but it does happen once in a while, where a person actually dies in the dream. And they experience their own death. Of course, for them, there is no death. They experience that person dying in the dream. And the person did die in the dream, but there was no death experience. But even if the whole dream blows up, there's no death experience because there's no death. For you, the idea of death, birth and death, is something you will never have the experience of at any time. You'll never experience being born and you'll never experience dying because the Atma, the self, is free of birth and death. It's free of change. All of these situations will change. Big changes in the situation, but of course if you got on the plane and went to China, you would be in a totally different situation within a few hours. Totally different. Big changes. if you drop your body, you'll be in another sphere, depending upon your karmas. You'll be visiting different lokas and eventually reborn here. But you're still there. So this idea of death experience is not there. But normally, whether you don't need to be a jnani, no one ever at any time has had a death experience, because the Atma is free of time, free of change, it's not objectifiable. So the you that is right now is, period. It's not subject to time. So this me that you are most attached to, this is the big discovery. So you mean this, the me that I take to be me, this me that makes me, is Brahman. It's this me that makes me, is infinite, is changeless, will never go away. It's not that there's some soul to discover or some giant Brahman out there to have an enlightening experience of. The enlightenment is that you have taken yourself that you are so attached to as you to be finite and subject to death. You know? And you recognize that that isn't true. And then you recognize it because you recognize yourself. You different, you're able to, through teaching, through the use of the pramana, really, to recognize your essential nature, who you are, you know? And then you realize that who you always are, and you can never get rid of it. You are changeless no matter what the experience is. And what is the very swarupa of that changelessness? It's amritam. It's free from death, but it's also sweet. It's what all the mystics call the beloved. There is nothing more beloved to you than yourself. It's Shivam. You know? You are the most beloved. Shivam means that which is the most beloved, the most auspicious. And there is nothing more dear to you than your own being, than the me. And so now what happens is that you recognize that, well, this me, it's really free from any type of change, and it's vibhum, it's all-pervasive. All-pervasive in the sense only of your experience. When you think of, it's easy to think of in the dream, when you have a dream or an imagination, that whole thing is pervaded, takes place in you. You're the very self of it. But if you have a thought, you can easily see. See, if I ask you to have the thought of a metal, you can easily see I am the self of that thought. I pervade the whole thought. I'm the truth of it. I'm the self of it. I'm pervasive to the thought. This room is a thought. You only know this room through your sense perception. This room that you're experiencing right now is only a vritti, it's the thought modification of the room. You're pervasive to this room as much as you're pervasive to an imagination or pervasive to the dream. But you can't have an experience that's away from being, which is consciousness. And so yourself is pervasive, your being is pervasive to all experience, and it's chid ananda. The nature of yourself is chit consciousness, which is anandam, which is fullness, which itself is, I'm just going through all of these terms now, is arupam. Arupam means you don't have a form. Consciousness doesn't have a form. And that's also very freeing to think about it. Like right now when you think of me, just you, just me, your own presence, not the body, not the sense organs, not the mind, not the emotions, just the sense of me. Then you ask, well, what form is that? Which size is it? What does it look like? What does me look like? Not the body, not the thoughts, not the emotions, not even the I thoughts, just me, the one that can't be objectified, the self-evident me, the one who's at the center of all experience. Your being is at the center of all experience, and it's self-evident. What form is it? It has nothing to do with form. What color is it? How tall is it? These words don't mean anything. They don't absolutely don't apply. Can anything be separated from it? Nothing touches you, but is anything away from you? Do you take up any space? All space exists in you, but do you take up space? Can you apply the concept of space to me? No, but is space away from me? No. That's the Maya. That's why I can say, have an imagination of a beautiful meadow. There's space, there's dimension, there's color, there's form. Space takes place in you, but you're free of space. If all the space is taking place in you, but you are free of space. Space comes and goes in you. And so you have to look for that, recognize that yourself is free of space, and yet all space exists in you. You have nothing to do with space. That's a beautiful meditation. That means this me, when you think of me, just the conscious being me. I like the word, to use the word me. That doesn't have space. But now, focus on just your own presence, and then look out at this room through your eyes. Now, where do you locate this me presence? Can you locate, see, here's the room. Can you locate me, your presence, anywhere in this room? Is it located in the body? Is the sense of me, just relax and say, is the sense of me located anywhere? It's the center of everything. But it's not located anywhere. Do you see that? Sometimes I say, put to me right in the middle of the room. I'll say, put it up here somewhere. It's not located in your body. Because your body's located in space. Your body is located in the space in the room. Right? And the space in the space of all of the objects in it, including your body, are located in me. I am the self, which pervades this whole thing, but I'm free of space. So you have to just kind of walk around seeing the truth of that. When I first realized it, I was at the ashram in India in the 70s, and Swami had been teaching and whatnot. I tell the story often, but I was walking down the pathway at the ashram going on my way to class, and who knows why, but for some reason, I was walking along, and all of a sudden I realized, I'm not walking. me, it wasn't anybody else, it was me. But me, the me, was not walking. This body was walking, and I still saw everything, but I realized that, oh my gosh, I, the me, what makes me, is not walking. I remember going like this. And then I turned my head like this. I wanted to see if the me would turn, if I would turn, if I thought I was going like this. And walking really slowly, because I didn't want to lose it. But I realized, no. Nothing's happening to me at all. And that's the truth of it. But it just has to be recognized. The identification is so much on the part of the mind. It's so much. But in fact, yourself is never, ever touched in any way. And as the mind starts to recognize that, to intimately know that, to recognize it, then the mind has this stable home, because you are completely stable. Completely stable, completely benign, completely non-judgmental, completely strong, so strong because nothing can topple you. Because you are what is, in fact. You are what is. Nobody can get behind you, topple you, nothing can happen. Mm-hmm. And so your mind, and you are Ananda. You are the beloved, really. And when the mind discovers that, it has a home base that even it can't do anything about. It can't spoil it. Mm-hmm. You can't make it better, and you can't make it worse. You can't take it away, you can't ruin it, you can't destroy it, neither can anybody else. Nobody can do anything. And so it is absolute safety. Because benign, you know, ananda. It is everything that you seek. But we're so used to superimposing it onto the world and running after it that we forget, we don't know that. But once known, the mind is free. Not because the mind is free. The mind is Maya. It's always changing. But you are free. And you are not away from the mind. And so now the mind is free because you are free. Because the mind self is free. And there's nothing that the mind can do about it. And so now here, that is, I'll just do this one last word, adbhutam. Adbhutam means, that is amazing. Adbhutam means, what an extraordinary wonder that is. It's adbhutam. There's nothing more wondrous than that. And that is the nature of yourself. So let's stop there and we'll start with the Umasahayam.
Oh, there's another start?
Next week. Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
And this is the Kaivalya.
Kaivalya.
Kaivalya. What does that mean? Upanishad?
Kaivalya. Kaivalya means kind of the one without a second. That which is auspicious, a complete blessing. One without a second. Kaivalya.
Different than Shiva, huh? Mm.
Shiva means auspicious too, but Kaivalya has the sense of one without a second.
I got a question. It's kind of a little bit away from this, but obviously nothing that's really away from what we just talked. This whole phenomenon of raga and dvesha,
yeah.
How to get out of this? I mean, is there any way to... If it's like the moment you open your eyes, the moment the senses get engaged, there is a certain... This Maya thing starts to spin, and then out of that comes this raga dvesha thing, and it's just like, I just still don't get it. I mean, I understand that I can bring about a certain consciousness that frees me from believing in that, right? That I somehow get. understanding the true nature of Ishvara, understanding what consciousness is really about, and that I'm not this limited body-mind complex, but that I'm actually Ishvara itself. So I kind of get that in a certain way. And I'm also, at the same time, experiencing in the three-dimensional plane, raga and dvesha. Now, knowing that any form of desire leads to suffering, and more raga and dvesha, I kind of would rather want to make a choice not to go there, but and not engage with that, and not to feed that process, because I know I'm going to end up with more suffering. The more I kind of spin that wheel, the more there's more, I'm generating more suffering. But at the same time, I can't disengage with that happening. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like any moment. I mean, it's like anything I touch, it seems like in this life, there's a certain kind of engagement with this rock dwish. You know what I mean? It's like,
mm-hmm. But there's a couple of things to understand here. One is, there's likes and dislikes, raga dvesha, likes and dislikes. And then there that are binding, and likes and dislikes that are non-binding.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you have a body and prarabdha, you will have preferences. So it's not like all of a sudden you gain knowledge and become totally neutral, everything is exactly the same. It doesn't happen. There are still preferences. I would like to have it this way, not this way. But it's non-binding, because if you don't get your preference, you're still fine. And if you get the thing that you don't like, you're fine. It's not like your ananda, your wholeness, your well-being is at stake. That's a non-binding, like and dislike. Now there's the binding ones. Those are a problem. Those binding ones are, I need this. This raga, I need this to be happy, and if I'm not, I will be unhappy. That is what causes suffering, not the non-binding.
Mm-hmm.
Non-binding are benign. It doesn't matter. If you get your way, you're fine, and if you don't, you're fine. Now, it's these binding ones where there is what we'll say, there's a lack of vairagya, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lack of vairagya means I need this to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
This is where your knowledge has to come in, because you have to first of all have so that you can develop this kind of karma yoga buddhi or attitudes that help or something to understand. Otherwise, those attitudes are just kind of a practice, and you have to keep applying them. There's no knowledge behind them; it doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand what is the nature, what gives you in the first place the experience of ananda, what gives the mind the experience of joy or bliss or happiness. What are the psychodynamics of the experience of happiness? And basically what those psychodynamics are is that in the world, when I have a strong desire for something, when I finally fulfill that desire, if I do, at the moment of fulfilling the desire, my mind becomes desireless. The moment I fulfill a desire, and if it's a strong, the stronger the better, because more concentration. So the moment I fulfill a desire, at that moment, my mind becomes desireless.
Mm-hmm.
Ashanta vritti. It becomes desireless, peaceful, calm. And in such a mind, the self, which is ananda, the swarupa ananda, the self, reflect in that mind in such a way as to give it a blast of joy in the shanta vritti. You know, how do I get the shanta vritti? Actually, there's lots of ways I can get a shanta vritti. Fulfilling a desire is only one of them. Another is listening to beautiful music, right? It makes my mind quiet. Taking a walk in nature makes my mind quiet. Smile of a child. So many things that can give me that shanta vritti that gives me a moment of happiness. But definitely the fulfillment of a desire. And so what is the age-old beginningless ajnana ignorance is that when I fulfill a desire, I become happy. Why? Because because I wanted that thing, and now that I get it, that thing is making me happy. But of course, that's an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
If that were true, you would have all of the things that you've ever had that made you happy. If you just filled the room with them, you'd be ecstatic. Right? Now I've got this thing that has some happiness, and this thing has some happiness. I've got two things. I've got twice as much happiness. And we get some more and some more and some more. That's not our experience. Our experience is this makes me happy, and then 5 minutes later I forget about it and I need the next thing. And it doesn't make me happy anymore at all. You know? Or it makes me happy some of the times, not all the time. And eventually it ends up, you know, at the garage sale. And move on. All things are like that. And all things make one person happy at one time, but not another person at that same time, etc. So your ananda really has nothing to do with the world. Now, that needs to be understood from all different directions.
Mm-hmm.
That the source of the ananda, the source of the well-being, is your own being. That's the source of it. And all the mind requires is to relax. So once you really understand these dynamics, then what happens is these desires to have things your own way more and more become not worth it. So they become more and more non-binding desires. That's what has to happen. You don't have to get rid of your desires, you have to convert them into non-binding desires. Okay, I want this, if I don't get it, fine.
Not worth it in the sense that
it causes suffering.
It won't give me what I want.
Not only it won't give you what you want, it makes life excruciating.
The clinging.
The clinging.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the clinging is caused by that I need this in order to be happy. And so what has to happen is some manana, some reflection has to be done on this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you find, every time you find yourself in one of these binding desires and are experiencing the, you know, somewhat excruciating pain that it's capable of causing you, you know, that's a good time to just kind of slow down for a minute and reflect on it. Not that you'll completely eliminate it right away,
mm-hmm.
but to give it some reflection time. You know, to kind of objectify it, to talk to the little one inside and say, do you really, what is it that you really need here? What is it that you really think you're going to get? And just play with it a little bit in a kind way, not in a non-judgmental way, just in a compassionate way to see what it is that you think this is really going to do for you. You know, and then slowly bring in your knowledge, and in that way you get a little distance on it. So I think it's very helpful to think of it in terms of going from a binding desire to a non-binding desire,
mm-hmm.
rather than from a binding desire to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real. You know?
Yeah, because it feels like there's this pool of vasanas coming out of the prarabdha karma.
There is. That's why you can't go. It's infinite. When this whole birth, from birth to death, is going to express in three ways, they say. One is what they call anyecha. Anyecha means a desire of another person will drag you into something to fulfill the prarabdha. Anyecha, anyecha. Anya means another. So the echa, the desire from another, will drag you in to make your prarabdha, to help you along. The next one is anyecha. It's nobody's desire. It's the creation creates the situation that you find yourself in. It's not that somebody's pulled you in. But the other one, the third one, is swecha, swaicha. Your own desire. It arises from you. The desire arises from your psyche. Why do you want to do this instead of this? What is impelling? Why is this desire impelling me to go this way? Because it's your swabhava, not swarupa, swabhava. Swabhava means it's the prakriti. Prakriti means it's the very Maya Upadhi that is manifesting now. It's mission. The mission of your life is the unfoldment in this direction. And that will come about in terms of the own desires rising out of yourself. Or people in your sphere will be pulling you pulling you into a situation. Or the creation itself, the situation itself will create. You know? But that swages, your own desire is really important to understand. And in fact, that's so, I find that so, I love that, in fact. You watch desires and movement take place in yourself, and all things like, oh, that's interesting, maybe. Because something's happening. Something's happening in me that's pulling me in a certain direction. You know? And so you can go with that. But it should be non-binding. If it's binding, then you need, that's a sadhana then.
That's a way.
Sadhana. It becomes your sadhana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to where you really sit with that and ask yourself and ask the child inside, why is this, why have I put so much into this?
Invested.
Why am I invested so much?
But
what is that about?
Working with these desires, can they better you or improve you in any way? I mean, or is it just really a dead end?
The desires can be useful in the sense that they're part of the fulfillment of your prarabdha, and they give you energy. So if you have no desires, you just feel, what would you do? You wouldn't even move.
Right.
Get rid of all desires, you're not even going to move. There's nothing wrong with a desire. It's when it's binding. It's when you decide that your well-being depends upon the fulfillment of the desire. And it doesn't. Your well-being is intrinsic. Your well-being is intrinsic. It is the very nature of the Atma. You know? It's the very nature of the self. Now, if you say, you know, well, you know, I don't want this body to die. Well, punch at it, or, you know, I don't want my mind to think, or I don't want to have this or have that. Well, that's not realistic. And in fact, in Punch at a Sheath, Vidyaranya says, to answering the question of a disciple, he says, I'm sorry, it's too late. It's too late because, you know, you've already taken this birth. You know, next time, okay, you won't take the birth, it's over. But this time, you know, you're already in the middle of it. And so
there's no stopping.
You can't stop this body from dying. You can't stop it from going through the pains of old age and death. You can't stop the prarabdha, which is 50% punya, 50% papa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you take a human birth, it's going to be, you know, a wash of sukha and dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
Means there'll be experiences that you would rather not have 50% of the time about. And so it's really to your advantage to not have binding desires.
It's what?
To your advantage not to have a binding desire. Like, what if you say, I'm just miserable because this creation doesn't accommodate my desires. It doesn't make things just the way I want them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be totally miserable. 50% of the time.
So when you spot a little bit of misery going on, that's the time to...
That's the sadhana. Your misery, the misery is just, you know, just a little way holding up the hand. You know? This is, you could be interested in it. This is something now for me to be with, to look at. This is my next little challenge.
Mm. Your karma is your dharma.
Yeah, your karma is your dharma. That's right. That's nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And since it's all mithya, since it's not real,
yeah.
It's not real, and since the truth is that you're Ananda, that you are Shivam. That is your nature.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these problems are, in the end, not real. You're not harming yourself. Yourself can't be harmed. That means that you can be interested in this. You can be this gamut of emotions that the human being is capable of having can be of interest to you. Like, oh, this emotion, this is unpleasant. Isn't this interesting?
Yeah, this is a real bummer.
This is very unpleasant. But what is unpleasant is the tremendous stress and strain on the mind that is producing, you know, that severe unhappiness. All that has to happen is that you have to bring your knowledge back in. And to bring your knowledge back in, there can be some complexity around that, because there's complexes inside, little children inside, and different reasons, different parts of you that are suffering and need some care. And so learning how to bring knowledge, age-appropriate knowledge, to the different parts inside, and age-appropriate care to the different parts inside that make up this upadhi at this time, is a skill. It's something to be understood, something to be learned.
So you don't just have yourself with the Vedantic vision, you talk a little bit.
The idea of a Vedanta stick is problematic, and that's not.
Somebody's having a nervous breakdown, and you are just one.
You don't exist right now.
So I mean, that's what in the Shankar has a little piece on this, and so does Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. I forget which, probably chapter 6, I think. I don't remember. Maybe it's 3 or 2. Sorry, they all blended together. But it has to do with, in the Karma Yoga, there's the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, which means that you accept everything as prasad from the Lord. You do the action, you go after the object of desire, but then you accept the results with a prasada buddhi. You don't have control over all of the results. It's all Ishvara. And so you take that result as prasad from the Lord, and then you can try again. It's not that means, oh, this is prasad, I'm not going to try again. You can try again, but then that result you have to take is prasad. And I remember doing that with one thing. I tried again and again and again, and Bhagavan kept saying no. And finally I said, okay, what can you do? You can try so many times, and then you get the hint, and the answer is no, that's it. But that's that prasada buddhi. But there's also what he calls kaushalam. Kaushalam means that skill. It's a skill. It's how dharma, how to handle situations appropriately. And that includes how to be with your own unconscious, how to be with yourself, how to be with others in a way that is ahimsa, means does not cause harm. That ahimsa buddhi needs, where we tend to be lacking, because I think most of us at least have some really understanding of ahimsa in terms of others in the world, and if we make a mistake, we work on it and try to correct it. But some of us don't even have a clue about this ahimsa in reference to ourselves. You know, how to be a good parent or a good person or a good mentor or a good teacher to all of our different parts of us. You know?
And that's a kaushalam.
That's kaushalam. It's a skill. It's an understanding. It's education. You know, we're not properly educated in terms of that, even on a psychological level, how to take care of our own self. Like even, we can look at it in terms of the buddhi's relationship to the manas. That buddhi is the intellect, that's where the one that gains knowledge, or the mind that gains this knowledge. The manas is the emotional mind, not even the unconscious, it's just the emotional mind, the reactive mind. This buddhi needs to be in relationship to that manas in a kind and helpful way. In a strong, helpful, kind, understanding, good friend way. If it's not, if it's like a little dictator or a little, you know, a bad boss or, you know, yeah, then everything just gets worse. The manas, the emotional mind, gets unhappy, and the unconscious gets really unhappy because it's already suffered from, you know, childhood traumas. You know what? No parent's a perfect parent, if that's impossible. But even the best parent, still, sorry, child's got a lot of traumas. It's just how it is. It's how it is. There's no escape. And so those, it can be very bad, but it's very bad if there's abuse. But if there's no abuse, there's still, all of us have things to work through.
So this play with the mind, it's universal. It's just a law of the mind. Or
no, the unconscious is universal. The unconscious is universal. Everybody's unconscious has this or that hurt in it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not a big deal.
Yeah.
It can be. I mean, if there was terrible, some people have been horribly abused and that type of thing, that's very tough. But for most of us, it's just, there are things in there that we need to take care of. You know? But we have to know about that. We have to even know that there's, that we need to do that. People don't even know they need to do that. That's kaushalya. You know? And they even talk about it in the Gita. You know, even though they don't have a sophisticated language for the unconscious, sophisticated in the way that our knowledge of the unconscious has developed over this last century, they talk about it still in their own way.
So is this the theme of the kaushalya, is that covered in the Gita Sutra?
Mm-hmm.
Which
especially second half of chapter 2, but all the way through, it'll be being brought out in different aspects.
So, could you just, in one sentence, translate kaushalya to just, because I mean, you talk about it in different ways, but could
it actually means skill.
Skill.
Kaushalya is a skill.
And then it involves ahimsa, the actually applying it.
It involves, when applying it involves dharma, an understanding of dharma, and I'm saying ahimsa.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, ahimsa is, you know, you have the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, and above that is ahimsa. Ahimsa is kind of dharma in one word, but then the problem is you have to keep talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because what is ahimsa? In one situation, what you might think is ahimsa could be himsa. You know? So then you go to the golden rule, and then from there you go into more specifics. And
I find it confusing sometimes as a former psychotherapist that to confuse the levels, like there's a certain amount of, it's healthy to have this sort of self-nurturing inquiry and to know when to disidentify from that, to abide in the self-evident awareness. I don't know, it strikes me as you're talking that it's, when the investment is so great, and it keeps intruding or pervading the awareness, like it occludes it.
Tell me a little bit more. No, not quite.
Like I'm thinking about recently, I've been sort of working through this, creative or like personal issue, and I recognize it as a process, and it keeps coming up in my mind, and I slowly sort of unfold it, you know, and like, what is it that I need and everything, but I don't know, sometimes it's a tendency, I think, to want to be more spiritual, say, you know, it's just a distraction, I've always struggled with that balance, trying to figure out when to disidentify or just how to work with it, you know. That maybe I'm being too exclusive between the spiritual and the psychological. But.
For me, I think the spiritual and the psychological have become one thing, in the sense that the psychological is just part of the general sadhana. It's an aspect of the general sadhana. And so it should be something that's integrated with spiritual sadhana.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. Because otherwise you could say not sadhana.
For me there's nothing that isn't sadhana.
Yeah.
Any pain on any level is
mm-hmm.
is a call.
Mm-hmm.
To
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then
and then I think our way of learning, there's so many different ways of learning how to be with that particular thing that's causing pain or confusion. There's a lot of different levels of being with that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that might be what you're talking about too. Mm-hmm. Like right now we're talking, just in the last few moments, talking about one way of being in terms of ahimsa and being with the inner child and all of that. Mm-hmm. But there's other ways of being with it. That's just one tool. There's also seeing that particular situation that's bringing about that pain, objectifying the whole thing and seeing it more cause-effect. All of the different cause and effect that have gone into creating, producing that particular situation. Mm-hmm. Actually producing the pain. There's many different things that have come together to actually produce this emotion. And you start seeing that production as Ishwara. So many cause-effect things come into the production of that pain or that situation, which is greater than any one person. And so then the whole thing you start seeing as Ishwara, and then that kind of frees it from yourself. It takes it away from you, and you see it as a product of a given order, of something that's produced out of a complex order. But there's a lot of different things like that, and it just depends. You have to choose for yourself which one is useful at this time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what level of dealing with this problem is useful right now? Mm-hmm. And if one doesn't work, you can go try another one. Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is a good point, you know, because there's a certain kind of understanding you need to bring to the process, and to sometimes unravel it, you know.
Unravel it, yeah.
So there's a psychological kind of necessity in a certain way to deal with certain things, but then you can also go overboard with the whole psychologizing thing and kind of miss the point of the teaching that we're really sitting in here for, you know?
Yeah, because each one of these things will eventually, if you take them one by one, you take care of it on this level, put it into this level, and then resolve it into yourself. Mm-hmm. But you can't emotionally bypass either.
Right.
If you don't take care of the little child, it's going to be left in, what about me? What about me? You're doing all of this stuff, and, you know, mm-hmm. I'm left alone. So you have to take care of everything on every level and then resolve it into your knowledge in the end.
Right. Also, kind of, I wish I had this interaction with someone, and I realized how strong this Prarabdha karma was working this person, you know, and then I was kind of trying to see how in the world could this knowledge help this person, being so identified with this part of the Prarabdha karma that is unfolding, but that they haven't kind of come to peace with, you know, and so there's this unfolding of this Prarabdha karma that I noticed, and then I said, how, you know, maybe that just needs to unfold, you know what I mean? That maybe this journey, the suffering, the pain, the constriction, the contraction and expansions that are experienced in that process are part of the person connecting with himself. You know, and
that's more for them to decide though than for
right,
me.
Right, yeah, yeah, no, I'm not saying for me. I'm just from my perspective trying to understand, you know, what is their process actually, you know, and is there anything that needs to be different about it or not, just for my own understanding, not that I needed to, you know, interface with them really, but it just kind of made so clear to me how strong these deep karmic patterns are in us, you know, and trying to come into right, what I call right relationship with the pieces of life, you know. So,
well, you know, it's like the end game. What we're doing is in a sense the end game, in terms of going from samsara to moksha, samsara to liberation. And you're going from this world being absolutely real, and you being this jiva, this individual in this absolutely real world that needs to become fulfilled and happy, mm-hmm. to recognizing that you are the whole, mm-hmm. and that the ananda that you seek is your own nature, that is a huge transition. And you have beginningless lifetimes living in the other, right? And so that path to a maturity,
mm-hmm.
to kind of psychological, spiritual maturity, I mean, it's really, it's a big deal in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a very serious game. You know, it's for real. It's really for real, and the challenges are real because we're so used to thinking of things in a different way. You know, we're used to thinking of myself. This is basically this is an unconscious universe, and I'm a conscious being that has to make my way. You know, and my anand and my fullness is out here to be gained, and that's kind of the grossest level. Yeah. And I have to go from that to I'm the whole. And so there's a lot of knowledge that's necessary and a lot of shifts of perspective. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't come right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It takes a lot of viveka, kind of a lot of vichara means a lot of analysis, a lot of really recognizing and understanding what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Really understanding, really seeing it, really differentiating your experience and then bringing your mind to it when you watch yourself just behaving in the good old ways, habitually. Yeah. So you bring your knowledge to that and you just it's actually, it's very thrilling in a way because you do watch your mind maturing and growing in the light of your understanding, but it takes some time.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very... I mean, this body does die. People die. Things that I thought were important, I lose. I mean, it's not that I kind of thought they were important. You know what I mean? It's not that I didn't really and truly take myself to be this body. I did. You know? It's incredible.
And then it's not so good to get too serious about it either, because then that drags you down too, you know? It's just such a dance, the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to be that. Once you really kind of understand, you don't have to worry too much because there's really nothing to worry about in terms of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's oodles of time. You've been here from beginningless time. So, you know, I mean, what difference does it make? We think, oh my gosh, I need to get everything right now, even though you've been here from beginningless time. And we worry about, you know, spending a few years, you know, or you know, many years, in fact, as though many years is anything compared to beginningless time. It's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of enjoy the ride. These are all just different things we think along the way. Oh, anyway, let's call it a night.